So in this session, we will be talking about why we are doing all this, using AI or tech ethics. What is the purpose in general? But we will also be thinking in somewhat specifically about why companies that are hiring computer science students, well, why they're specifically interested in having this as part of their strength. So there's the general, I think there's a general component as to why someone would want to do AI ethics, but there's also a very professional aspect. And we'll be talking about both of those two things in this section. And this section will also be, in some sense, a sort of review of the first part of the ethics discussion, that is the ethics of questions about me and who I am in the world of artificial intelligence and technology, questions about autonomy and dignity and privacy. So those are the two things we're talking about today. We're talking about why we're doing ethics and the ethics we have done. And I think that we could divide up the reasons why AI ethics have become so important recently into five general areas. The first is that ethics provides a human language or human metrics to measure tool success. And of course, we all know the phrase that if you can't measure something, you can't improve it. So that ethics is critical in this sense, right? If we're going to measure how well tools work in human terms, then ethics will play an important role, not only in telling us what we have, but in telling us when things are getting better or getting worse. And the second subject will be the idea of enhancing technical design. We'll talk a little bit about how ethics helps make the machines work better, building user trust and shaping company culture are also important. We'll talk a slide or two about that. And then finally, the heart of what we want to talk about is this last item number five, risk mitigation and legal compliance. This is going to connect with the idea of artificial intelligence or technology ethics audits, which are becoming increasingly prevalent now, not only for practical reasons that companies would like to have them done, but also, and perhaps to some extent more importantly, they are becoming part of a regulatory structures of artificial intelligence and information technology. And so they are being, in essence, required in many cases. For example, here in New York City, ethics audits are required of information technology software that is used in the hiring process. And specifically, people are interested there in one of the ethical values that we will be studying soon, fairness. But the general idea that regulating bodies are now requiring ethics audits as a way of managing artificial intelligence socially, this seems to be growing quite rapidly. Of course, also in Europe, the mandated the mandate of ethics audits is something that is apparent in the AI Act and in other recent pieces of legislation, and it appears to be perhaps even the core of what regulation will look like in Europe as far as artificial intelligence goes, at least in the near future. So for all the reasons that they exist to use ethics for those working with technology and artificial intelligence, there are many reasons, but I think the most practical and substantial is that last one, the idea of a mandated AI ethics. And so what I want to say is that the lessons we're learning in this seminar will allow you to participate in and actually construct those ethics and those audits, and we'll talk a little bit about that today. All right, so that's an overview of what we have going. Let's just take these reasons in order. So the first reason why we're doing all this stuff that we're doing is to provide a human language metrics to ultimately determine success of artificial intelligence tools. And we've talked about this case. This is the Cardicio case, where The software was developed to read a person's EKG and then compare that heart rate or that heart map, let's say, with that of many, many other people in order to identify those patients who might be at risk of cardiac events or heart disease in the near future. And we said that initially, the machine was a great technical success. It was a great mathematical success. It was a great numerical success, or at least it appeared to be so, because it successfully identified almost everyone, or perhaps everyone, that was going to have a heart problem in the near future. The tool was very sensitive. If there was anything possibly that might go wrong, it would detect that. Now, that kind of detection is a great technical accomplishment. And the engineers were justifiably proud of what they had done. And they rode that accomplishment into the deployment of their tool. But as we recall from the previous discussion, what happened out in the real world was a catastrophe. That is, the tool was so sensitive that it ended up flagging all kinds of false positives. That is, telling people left and right that you might have a heart problem when really they weren't going to have a heart problem. Now, I mean, in the abstract, in kind of the numerical world of math, that makes sense, right? I mean, you say, look, I would prefer to get all the people who really will have a problem, even if that means giving a lot of false warnings out. But that's theoretically. That's in the lab where you're doing the technology. Out in the world where people live and where ethics happens and where we talk about things like autonomy, what actually happened was that the results of this this excellent technical tool were very negative. Because even though it would be true in terms of autonomy that for some few patients receiving an early warning as to possible heart disease could in fact increase their autonomy, they find out sooner that something might go wrong, they can go get it treated and live better as a result of that. Even though that is true, the losses on the other side, that is people who were forced to live with this false anxiety and worry about something that was highly unlikely to happen, that more than negated, it seemed at least to us, the positive quality of the tool. So the important point is that the mathematical accuracy and the technical success of the tool masked the fact that in human terms, the tool was a failure. And what brought out that distinction, what allowed us to see that the tool wasn't working, was an ethics audit, where we said, look, let's not just talk about positive and negative, false and diagnoses, positive, true positives, false positives, true negatives, false negatives, those kinds of things. Let's not just talk about those numerical results, and instead talk about how people live in the world. So, and then you recall that we responded to that by instituting at least, right? We at least said, we're not going to have just red and green, bad and good. We're at least going to add this yellow area where we say we're not sure exactly what's happening, but there's no, on the one hand, we cannot provide a completely clean bill of health. It's not perfect heart rate. But on the other hand, we also cannot identify an imminent danger or risk. Right? So at least to some extent, that autonomy clipping, that autonomy constricting that occurred in the machine, or some of that constriction was alleviated by the ethics. So the tools, then to wrap this up, the best tool to measure how well this heart EKG product works is not mathematical accuracy. It is human autonomy. And those are completely different, obviously, those are completely different ways of speaking, completely different ways of measuring. And if they're completely different ways of measuring, then what counts as improvements or making the machine worse, that too is going to be completely different. So the first, and I think that with the exception of the ethics audits, this is the most important of the various reasons. The first reason for doing ethics is it allows people in computer science the language and the metrics that are required to see and determine whether their tool is actually working or not. And because they have those metrics, as opposed to the just the mathematical numbers, you are empowered to make the machine work better. So ethics is what gives you the power to do your job better. That's a powerful reason. Power is a good word for today. That's a powerful reason for ethics. Right? Ethics is what lets you do your job better. Now, of course, technical expertise, numerical success in terms of accuracy and so on, those things are important, but they're only important within the scope or within the direction that ethics provides. So if you don't have ethics, you can't make your machine work. And there's just a clear example here. The machine was mathematically powerful. It was technically accurate. It was extraordinarily successful from a purely engineering point of view. But in the real world, it was counterproductive. To make it work in the real world, you needed ethics. So ethics allows machines to work in the real world by giving the measurements, in this case, autonomy, providing the language of measurement, which allows us to understand what a better and worse tool is. Okay, so that's the first idea. And then related to that, there is the second idea, which is that ethics enhances technical design. Understanding ethics empowers designers for success on the right target. So in a certain sense, I think this is a way of repeating what I just said, but with slightly different language. And here I have these targets, the three targets that are in a line and are just red and white. Those targets are frequently used by, you find those frequently in sort of Twitter feeds or LinkedIn posts by computer scientists who want to talk about, in very efficient and quick ways, about precision and accuracy in their tools. And so the A target there of the red and white targets, the A target has pretty good accuracy. The shots are all clustered around the center, but it's not very precise. That is, the shots are scattered about. The B target has good precision. The shots are all gathered together. If you aim in one place, it tends to get in that place, but it's not very accurate. It's off target. Then C is both precise and accurate. So that's good. Those are important measurements. How precise and how accurate is your data? But going back to the previous slide, what's even more important than how precise and how accurate your data is with respect to the target, what's even more important is, what is the target? Right? You need to decide that first. The precision and accuracy don't matter until you've determined which of these other targets, and I've got these three set in kind of a triangle here to represent that, the idea, say, of privacy, autonomy, and dignity, that you're aiming at. So it's not just that ethics gives you the language, autonomy, privacy, dignity, to make things better or to understand that your tool is failing and not working well. It's not just that. It's that it provides the broad idea, right, that there are these different targets out there, and you need to start first by figuring out what target you're aiming at. Again, maybe user autonomy in the case of the EKG thing. And only then, and this is the key point, only then does it even make sense to talk about things like accuracy and precision. Now, this is not to say that accuracy and precision are unimportant. They're terrifically important, of course. But they're only important if you're aiming at the right target. It doesn't matter how accurate or precise you are, or even what the difference is between accuracy and precision, if you're aiming the wrong way. So that's the second. And I think in a sense, I'm kind of cheating here. I'm saying the first point twice, but I'm doing that because I think it's so important, right? It's not just that on the one hand, the ethics allows you the language and the measurements, the metrics to chart better and worse. It's also even before that, it's what allows you to aim your tech tool in the right direction in the first place. I mean, you have to start with something like, what do I want to do for my users? Do I want to increase their autonomy? Do I want to make sure I do not violate their privacy? And so on. Okay. So I say that understanding ethics empowers designing for success on the right target, right? I mean that literally, on the right target, meaning are we aiming for autonomy or dignity or something else? Okay. So those are two ways, I think, of saying the same thing, but important. Then reasons 3 and 4, I'm sort of grabbing just in this billboard here, the privacy, that's iPhone. Ethics does help companies build user trust. At least there are indications, and you can look up the standard journals for sociological studies to this effect, that users are more likely to trust companies and engage in their products and things when they feel as though their autonomy is being respected, that is, they're not being manipulated by the company. This is not some great insight. I mean, of course, people are going to want to work with companies that they don't feel like are manipulative. Of course, people are going to be more likely to engage with a product when they don't feel like they are being manipulated. So companies that put a stress on autonomy or that put a stress on privacy are, it makes perfect sense, more likely to have gain the trust and engagement of users. So that would be another payback or another reason for incorporating ethics into the design and deployment of technological information technology and AI tools, simply to build trust in and engagement with user, build engagement between the product and users. And then number 4 is sort of on the other side. If number 3 is building trust between the product and users, number 4, the idea that you can shape company culture, is something like building trust between the product and the designers and developers themselves. And here I'm thinking just about people like you, people who are actually making these tools. Most people like you are like most people like me are like most people in the sense that we like to know what we are doing with our lives. We spend a lot of time at work. And if we're working, I guess I can't speak for anybody but myself, but it just seems to me that it's not going to be obvious for most everybody that they are going to be happier at work, more productive at work, if they have some sense of and believe in what they are doing. If you're working on a product that you know is intentionally taking away users' autonomy or stripping their privacy, I mean, it's hard to get fired up to go to work in the morning when you're doing that to other people. Now, of course, sometimes you get compensated for that with money. Money also helps, and that's true. So it's a complicated thing, right? I'm not saying that ethics is the answer to everything or that ethics is the only thing that happens in the world, but I am saying that it plays a role, a significant role, in people being happy at their work and being happy with themselves. I don't mean that it plays a role in the sense that it makes you more ethical. I don't like that phrase because I don't believe there is such a thing as more or less ethical. But it creates satisfaction because you have more understanding yourself of what you are doing, both as a creator of a tool that goes out and works in the world, and just in general as the kinds of values that you as a person exist to express and exemplify and privilege and prioritize, right? There are some people who, just by virtue of who they are going to want to prioritize autonomy. They're going to say, look, this is the big thing. I want to be involved in projects which are about autonomy because that's what I believe in for myself, and that's what I want to see around me, which is terrific. Other people might have a different value, like, for example, fairness. Some people might say, for me, what's most important is not so much my personal freedom, but a society where everyone is treated justly. Well, that's also great. I'm not for or against one or the other relative to each one. That makes sense. I'm not trying to say autonomy is better than fairness or fairness is better than autonomy. I am trying to say that people in general will be happier if they know what are the kinds of products they are building and the kinds of projects that they are involved in are exist in solid support of autonomy or exist in solid support of fairness. And they'll be more happy because it allows them to associate their own values, their own views, and their own lives with their project. That just seems obvious to me. Again, everyone has to make their own decision. I mean, and like I say, we are not blind. We also understand perfectly that people will do things for money. It's true, happens, of course. Of course it happens. But that's not the only reason people do things. And so I think ethics can play a role in, I don't want to use the word inspire, but I want to say something like encouraging people to be engaged in their own work and enjoying their own work. So that would be a fourth reason for having this course and for doing technology ethics. And now we come to the fifth idea, and this is I'm going to talk about it briefly here. Then we're going to take just a quick break, and then we're going to talk about it more. But let's here just give kind of a general idea of why we are doing AI or tech ethics within the area of risk mitigation and legal compliance. What is being said here is the following. Two things are being said. First, the advance of technology is coming so quickly that it is outrunning laws and regulations generally. So a very good example of this is the European Union AI Act, which was recently promulgated, but it was supposed to be promulgated about 9 months before it was, but something happened. Just as they were about to release this giant legislative accomplishment, I guess you could call it an accomplishment, but this giant piece of legislation, this thick bill of regulations that they had been working on for years, just as they were about to release that, guess what happened? ChatGPT and large language models and the image and the DALL-E and the stable diffusion, the image generators, generative AI happened. Now, generative AI was not a significant part of the AI Act. So the author said, oh, wait a minute, we better take this back to the shop and add some sections to account for generative AI because it's such a big deal, which is fine and great. So they take it back to the shop and then they bring it back up. But then in the meantime, other advances are made in the area of retrieval and rapid searching of the internet. And other advances are made in still other areas and so on. My point is that it's a losing, up to now, it has been a losing battle. As opposed to the industrial economy, which went at a pace that more or less matched human politics. That is, legislators did not have trouble keeping up with technical advances in the industrial era, with new ways of making steel or new ways of making cars, and so on. Maybe there were moments where the industry got ahead of the government, but the government fairly quickly caught up. So we haven't had historically large gaps between technical innovation and government regulation. However, with the dawning of artificial intelligence and information technology, we are seeing those gaps. We're seeing wide gaps and inconsistent gaps. That is, we keep finding, our governments keep finding themselves behind. So the regulations are not in place to manage the technologies that are in use. So what does that mean? Now, companies, justifiably, they worry about this a little bit. One reason why companies want law and want regulation is because it's kind of covers, in English we have a phrase, it covers your rear end. It means it gives you It provides a way for companies to say, even when things go wrong, when a company creates a product that causes a problem, if regulation already exists, what the company can say is, and truly and reasonably, they can say is, look, there were regulations that told us what we should and should not do. We obeyed those regulations. Therefore, if something goes wrong, it's not really our fault. It's the regulator's fault. It's the government's fault for passing bad laws. And there's actually good reason to think that there's some truth to that in many cases. Whether there's truth to it or not, regardless, it functions very well for companies because, as I say, it gives them, covers their rear end. It gives them a way of saying, look, if bad things happen, it's not really our fault. Now you can disagree with them and you can say it really is their fault, but at least there's a debate there, right? What's going on with technology now and artificial intelligence is there's no regulations. And so companies are, in a sense, nude, right? That is, if something goes wrong, they can't blame it on someone else. It's clear who they are and that the company is the one that developed this technology. There were no regulations in place, which is good, in a sense, because it allows innovation. No doubt about it, lack of regulation allows companies to run forward very quickly. So that's good. The problem is when things go wrong, as I say, then the companies get blamed. So it's very natural that in that kind of situation, and when there is no exterior way for a company to set up blame for things that go wrong, it's natural that some companies will look for internal ways, and ethics provides some cushioning there for mistakes or errors that might happen in the world. So if a company hires an AI ethicist to look at their product, right? If a company hires someone like me or you to come in and give an analysis of what they're doing, which is just like the analysis that we did of Cardicio, the heart EKG thing, and the many other cases we have discussed so far and will discuss, if a company hires us to come in and do that, then if something goes wrong, the company can reasonably say, look, something went wrong, but we did all we could to protect against that outcome. We even hired someone like Brousseau to come in and tell us what might go wrong, like in the case of Cardicio. The hiring and doing ethics, of course, provides no guarantee that against things going wrong. Things will always go wrong regardless of what people do. But it does present, for most companies, it does present a way of affirming that they took positive steps in order to avoid negative outcomes. And of course, for a small startup, that's not so important. But when companies get larger, for example, Facebook has hired a philosopher to do ethics. As a company gets larger and the potential losses become greater, the negative effects of errors become more extreme, then it makes more sense for them to hire or to have a kind of ethics overview of what is being done in the company. And it makes sense going both ways. It makes sense to avoid problems, and that's the main point, right? To avoid problems before they arise by looking at things like privacy, by looking at things like autonomy. So you avoid problems before they arise, but even if they arise regardless, you then, this is the very practical component, then you have someone to blame. You can say, look, it was the philosopher that did it, or the ethics person. Now, you're taking this course to perhaps be part of the ethics committee on your companies. So that means you're being set up to be sort of the victim here. There is some of that that goes on, but I prefer to underline the positive part, that you're also directly involved in the fundamental decisions about what direction the company will go in with respect to its development and deployment of its key products. So there's the positive and the negative. Being involved with ethics does give you a front row participation in what a company is doing. But it does expose you a little bit to some blame if things go wrong. So that's the idea of risk mitigation. Companies that are acting with outside the rule of law and regulation, not because they're outlaws, they're criminals, but instead because they're in advance. They've just gotten way out ahead of the government. So companies that are outside of law and regulation look to ethics to, one, to avoid negative outcomes. That's one side of risk mitigation. And two, if there is a negative outcome, to at least be able to say, look, we did everything proactively that we possibly could. Okay, so number five is risk mitigation and legal compliance. Legal compliance is simply that structure of risk mitigation applied legally. So what has happened? What has happened over the last 5 or 10 years is that it's become clear, maybe the last 5 years, it's become clear that regulators are just not going to be able to keep up with the technology the way they would like. And governments and just people have noticed that companies are using ethics in this role in order to, one, preemptively avoid problems or negative outcomes, and also to give some accountability to say, look, we tried to avoid problems. Here's some people who were in charge of that, and we should talk to them to figure out what went wrong. Right? That's accountability. There is someone to some extent, blame. So seeing that that structure has played some role in compensating the inability of governments to keep up with innovation, governments are now mandating this kind of ethical action. And this kind of ethical action is usually called an ethics evaluation or an ethics audit. And so what governments are saying is, look, we're not going to be able to get the rules and regulations out there fast enough to handle everything that's coming down the pike in terms of new innovation. But what we can do is we can tell you, the company, that you must subject yourself to the kind of ethics audit that many companies were doing voluntarily anyway. Right? All the ethics audits that I have done were voluntary. Companies said, look, we want to have a good sense of what metrics we should use for success, what kinds of negative outcomes might evolve. And maybe they wanted someone to blame. They usually don't say that, but maybe they did. in any case, all the audits that I have been involved in personally have been voluntary. That is, the companies have wanted to get some ethical input. And then, just stepping back from this a little bit, I don't want to leave this idea in the air that somehow ethics is just about avoiding problems or having accountability or blame. For companies, and my experience tells me that for companies, the best reason to get people who know about ethics involved is that it helps the technology. It makes the technology better by providing these metrics for success and failure, and it helps the designers understand how to aim their work. So ethics, the top reason for ethics is it makes the technology better. Absolutely. But we can't deny this other reason, which is this accountability reason, or this idea that ethics plays a kind of defensive role in ensuring that that bad things don't happen, and when they do, there is accountability. And so it's in that second part of the reasoning in favor of AI ethics that we're concentrating now. And that's number five. And what I would like to do next is show you how you actually do an AI ethics audit. So that's the first part. The first part is we've listed these reasons for doing AI ethics and the value they add. And maybe you can take 5 minutes to recover that in your mind and list for yourself how those five reasons make sense. And what we will move on to now is the idea of using ethics, the idea of evaluations or audits. So I think also the AI or tech ethics audits are important because just professionally, there actually are jobs in this. I mean, someone who has good skills in computer science and good skills in ethics is going to do very well in the work in the marketplace over the next, at least for the foreseeable future. So it's a good skill to have for just living your life. We can look here at ChatGPT and ask what an AI ethics audit is. So we'll kind of start there to get some kind of general sense. In 50 or fewer words, I'm having trouble typing today. Please describe a tech ethics audit. So let's see what ChatGPT says a tech ethics audit is. Okay, a tech ethics audit or an AI ethics audit is a systematic evaluation of a technology or digital system to ensure it aligns with ethical standards and values. That's more or less right. This process assesses aspects such as privacy, fairness, bias, transparency, and social impact to identify potential ethical risks and suggest improvements. All right, I think that's a pretty decent definition, actually, of what a tech ethics audit is. And so we can more or less accept that one, I think, in this case. I would say in my terms, and this is pretty similar, I would say that an ethics audit casts technology in ethical or humanist terms as opposed to scientific, economic, and legal terms. Right? And then the example, I've given this example before, just in 2 minutes, the example of the iPhone is that, look, you can think of your iPhone, you can measure how well it performs in physical terms, how much does it weigh, how long does the battery last, and so on. You can measure how well it performs in economic terms, how much does it cost, and so on. You can measure how well it performs in legal terms. Does it obey laws about, for example, how strong the signal is and the battery dangers of exploding and things like that. And you can evaluate it in ethical and humanist terms, which is, does this phone provide autonomy, privacy, fairness, and so on? And that's what an ethics audit does. It just evaluates the product or the technology in human terms. And then this was also in the ChatGPT point. It also ensures or evaluates how well the technology serves fundamental human rights. That's a little bit more, there's a kind of more noble way of saying it, right? For someone like me, who's more curious and more exploratory and investigative, what I like is to say that ethics audits allow us to explore how well machines work in terms of privacy and autonomy and so on. But if you want to speak very nobly, you can say it helps technology serve fundamental human rights, which are autonomy, privacy, and so on. So you can take more the curiosity approach, which is what a philosopher will do, or you can take more the fundamental human rights approach, which is a little more political, I suppose. Either way, what you end up doing is an AI ethics audit. So what is an AI ethics audit? Well, AI ethics audits are composed of three parts. There's a social technical scenario, there's the actual evaluation or auditing segment, and then there's a report or recommend segment. So those are the three components of an AI ethics audit or just a tech ethics audit, and we will look at them in order. First, the social technical scenario. This is in the background, there is a picture from one of the several social technical scenarios I have been involved in, from one of the several tech ethics audits I have been involved in. And the way these audits always start, is very, very interesting, is with a meeting. Now, typically, because you're getting many different people from many different places, the meeting is on Zoom, but it doesn't have to be. It could be in person. But regardless of whether it's on the computer or in person or what have you, the initial meeting or maybe set of meetings is terrifically interesting. And what you do is you try to gather you try to gather all stakeholders, meaning everyone who is involved in one way or another with the tool or the technology that you are evaluating. And we ask, the question I put it here is, what do you need to know what we are talking about? In a certain sense, the socio or social technical scenario is just, what is it we're talking about? So in the case of a technology like a healthcare tool, in order to understand what we're even talking about, we need to gather together some computer scientists who can tell us specifically what the tool does, how it works, where its powers are, where its possible weaknesses are. Where does the data come from? What kind of prediction does it produce? How reliable are these predictions? What kind of errors have occurred in the past? Things like that, technical things. We also have ethicists who can talk the way we've been talking in this class, who can say things like, well, does this machine serve autonomy? Does it, what are the privacy by design elements that have been involved in the making of this machine, and so on. There are also, if it's healthcare, regardless if it's healthcare or not, whatever the field is, you want domain experts. That is, people who are working in the field where the machine applies. If it applies in hiring, you would want experts in human resources. If it applies in law, you would want some lawyers. If it applies in medicine, you want some doctors. So if you're going to talk about a machine, let's say that an artificial intelligence image system which looks at a lesion on the skin and diagnoses whether or not it is skin cancer, well, you would want some dermatologists, some doctors who are focused in this particular kind of disease. So you have your computer scientists, you have your philosophers, ethicists, you have your doctors, and then you might want a lawyer or some representative of the company to talk about what the company wants out of the machine. Usually the company wants some profit, but what else does the company want out of the machine? And then, of course, on the far end, you would like to have some users. What do the patient, if the case is that it's a healthcare device, then in some sense we're talking about patients. So what do the patients want out of the machine? Or if it's a legal machine, then it's the clients. More generally, we would say, what do the users want from the machine? So you gather up people who are involved and who know something about the machine from each one of these angles, right? The computer scientists who make the machine, ethicists, doctors in the specific domain, people for the company, and users or patients. And what you do is go around in a circle and have everyone ask everyone, well, first explain to everyone else what they see in the machine and ask everyone else if there's any questions, or ask others how it is that what they are seeing relates to what, say, I am seeing. What this means in practical reality is that I, as the philosopher, will ask the computer scientist to explain to me in language that I can understand, not in language for other computer scientists, but in language that I can understand, how the machine works. And the doctor will say the same thing, and the user, and so on, so that the computer scientist will have to be able to explain the machine in a way that is comprehensible to all the stakeholders. And this might require multiple explanations, right? One explanation is provided for the other computer scientists in the group. One explanation might be provided for the lawyer in the group. A different kind of explanation might be provided to the doctor than to the ethicist. And we all listen to all these explanations, and we all participate by providing our own perspectives on how we see the machine. And what develops over the course of this conversation is that everyone, in a certain sense, learns the language of everyone else involved. So, for example, we all know doctors have a very precise language. If we're talking about dermatology, then the philosophers and the computer scientists need to learn some technical terms about dermatology. And then, of course, patients too have a very different feeling, right? A very different reaction. For them, skin cancer is not something technical. Skin cancer is something that they're anxious about, or could kill them, or that hurts, or something else. It depends upon the patient and the person. But what goes on here, again, is that all of the aspects of the subject at hand, the AI tool, the specific diseases we're talking about, the philosophy, the doctors, the lawyers, all those things are repeated over almost over and over again until everyone understands everything. And this is a fairly long process, but it's very, very, well, in my experience, it's very, very interesting. And you learn a lot about, I've learned a lot about computer science. I've learned a lot about medicine. I've learned a lot about law. I've learned a lot about ethics from other philosophers involved in these things. It's a very interesting process of kind of translation, right? That the doctors translate their ideas into language that everybody can understand. And I do the same thing, right? I need to translate the sorts of things that I am saying, what I mean about privacy, what I mean about autonomy, into language that everyone understands. If I just go into a meeting and I say, oh, well, this machine doesn't improve autonomy, no one understands what I'm talking about, right? I have to define what autonomy is. And then I have to give specific example of, well, this is a way that it is limiting a user's autonomy, and this is another way where it might be maximizing or supporting a user's autonomy. And I say autonomy is self-determination, and autonomy is, maybe you think of it as freedom, and autonomy is this idea that you give rules to yourselves. And I just say it over and over again until everyone understands what I'm talking about. And everybody, as I say, everybody does that. So the socio-technical scenario is the process wherein everyone who's involved in this design and deployment of the technology gathers. And just in this, here you see, this is a picture from a real Zoom call in which I was involved. I'm actually there off on one side. You can see with the white background and the blue shirt, in which we all just talked, listened to each other talk, and got an idea of what the machine was. And then members of our group, this is actually just kind of a selection. Our groups usually have kind of 20 people. They were very large groups. Then some members of the group would take responsibility for writing down what it was that we actually said. There's actually now software, there's artificial intelligence software that has the ability to listen to these meetings and give kind of a first draft of what was said. And so the way we do it is we get that kind of first draft, we put it up as a Google Doc, then we all asynchronously, that is whenever we want, we just go to the Google Doc and read it. And what happens in this second phase, this is still a socio-technical scenario. We are in some sense correcting what we have said. So I look at the ethical and philosophical explanation of autonomy that was discussed. And if maybe it's misrepresented or miswritten there, I will make a change in the Google Doc and rewrite it in a way which is more accurate, I think. Or I might see something that is written about the medical condition. I might write a comment in the Google Doc, like, could you explain this in more detail? What exactly is an alpha lesion and that, something like that? I'm just making that up. And so you have a kind of second conversation that exists on the Google Doc. And what that allows you to do is see more carefully exactly what is happening. So the socio-technical scenario is kind of a double play. The same thing happens twice. First, there's kind of a live meeting where everyone talks about the technology and understands it in ways and presents and understands it themselves and presents understanding that they have in ways that are comprehensible for everybody. And then the same thing repeats on the Google Doc, where you kind of make a written report of what you said, and where you simply have headings like preliminary thoughts about the ethics of the machine. Autonomy is important, privacy is important, and so on. Preliminary thoughts about the function, the AI functioning of the machine. This is a neural network which has this many layers, and and preliminary thoughts about the medical aspects of the machine. The doctors say skin cancer causes death in 9% of the cases. Therefore, we should think about, I can't recall exactly what the numbers were, but right, if skin cancer causes death in 9% of the cases, then it's pretty important that we have a strong sensitivity. That is, in that case, it might be worth having more false positives, because missing a positive, getting a false negative, because it's positive, again, a false negative could have lethal consequences. So the doctor will talk a little bit about what true falses, true positives and false positives and how important those things are, depending upon how lethal the disease is. And lawyers will say their thing and so on. And so you have a set of paragraphs for each person. And by the time you're done, you can read that document and someone could just come off the street and read that document and they would have a really good idea of how the machine works. And they would have a really good idea of how the machine works in technical terms, in ethical terms, in legal terms, in medical terms, and for the patient. So that's the social technical scenario. It starts with a meeting just like the one you see, and then progresses through this the writing of the Zoom document where you leave the document open for a month or something, depending upon how urgent it is or how many people. And just every few days or a few times during that month, you go into the document and read it and add comments and respond to any comment someone has posed to you. And you end up with a decent kind of first draft that, as I say, explains in essence what the social technical scenario is. What's happening here? What are we talking about? Right? That's the first step. Okay. That's the social technical scenario. The second step is the actual evaluation. It's the actual audit. And here, depending upon the size of the group, you will examine the tool in ethical terms. Now, if the group is large, then you can break up in, if the whole group of evaluators is large, you can break up into smaller groups. Or if not, if it's a smaller group, you might just choose a few people to take the lead here. And typically in these groups, of course, you're going to have an ethicist there, and the ethicist and maybe at least one computer scientist and at least one doctor should be involved if it's a medical tool. And then, of course, you have the socio-technical scenario also to refer to. And what you do is you write section 2 of the paper right there on the Google Doc. You go through and you think about the various ethical principles and how the machine relates to it. Now, the way this actually works is that I have the idea here of top down and bottom up. It works in the following way. First, the people who are gathered in the group, and also this occurred in the socio-technical scenario, people just naively, and I don't mean that naive in the sense of unintelligently, I just mean naively in the sense of thinking about their personal experience. People naively think about what kinds of ethical concerns might arise from this machine. And they do that without reference to any particular set of principles or education about this subject and so on. They just say, I'm concerned that I get a false positive from this machine and then I will end up living a very constricted life when I really don't need to. That's a valid concern, but that's a bottom-up concern. It's not something that someone came up with because they were aware of ethical principles. It's instead just a feeling they had about the machine, a human response to it. So the one way that you work in the evaluation is you take those human responses and you package them inside the ethical principles that you use. Now, quick footnote, which ethical principles do you use? Well, that's a selection you need to make as part of kind of the administration of the whole thing. But the ethical principles we are using is more or less in concert with the ethical principles that almost everyone uses. And those are the principles, the ethics of me, which is autonomy, dignity, and privacy. Then there's the ethics of us. This is how we get along together. There's fairness and solidarity or equity and social well-being. Then there's the ethics of the machine, which is its performance, explainability, and safety. We will talk more about those things later. What's important now is this idea that when you have a bottom-up concern, you have just a human reaction to the machine, and then you package it or try to understand it in terms of the ethics principles. Now, why do you want these ethics principles? You want the ethics principles because you need some way of organizing this work. I mean, if you don't have some organizing structure, intellectual, ethical structure, the whole thing just becomes a mess, right? It's everyone says, well, this is bad, and this is bad, and this could be this way, and this other thing could be that way. What gives discipline to the evaluation, What allows you to build a final document which is coherent, in which people can easily understand and pass from one to another, are these ethical principles. So autonomy, privacy, and so on. It's what allows you to say, these are the things that we need to talk about when we talk about the humanity or the human effects of the machine. So when you're doing the actual evaluation auditing, there are two jobs you have. The first is you take these raw human feelings and you put them into the language of the AI ethics principles. You say, look, what you're feeling and what you're saying is an expression of autonomy. Just like we do with Cardesia, when we said, look, this machine is possibly going to give false positives, and then I'm going to waste my time and be worried about living and so on when really I'm not at risk. And then what you, so a user says that. Then what you do in the AI ethics audit is you say, okay, when you're saying that, what you are really saying is that you think the machine has an autonomy problem. It constricts your autonomy. That's the idea of bottom up. Right? You take these raw human reactions and you put them into the language of the principles. And again, the reason you're doing that is so you can get a result which is organized, which you can easily communicate to others. Then going the other way, top down, right, that more or less starts with the philosophers and ethicists. Then we say, okay, let's just start with the idea of autonomy. Let's explain what that is. And then let's go to the machine and see if we think that the machine performs well or poorly in terms of autonomy. Or we ask, in what ways does the machine affect human autonomy? And in what ways does the machine affect human dignity? And in what ways does the machine affect human privacy? And later on, fairness and other things we will talk about. But the idea is going top down means you start with the principle, and then you go look at the machine and the human experience of the machine. Bottom up means you start with the human experience of the machine, and then you try to figure out how it fits into the principle. So for example, here I have a picture here. This is another ethics audit that I was involved in. It is the AI use of music. And what's going on here, it's kind of hard to see behind the words, but the person is playing an acoustic instrument. That acoustic music is being fed into a computer, which you see here. Then that computer is converting that music into physical vibrations. And the people seated watching, you can't see this, but they are wearing vests that have little motors in them. And the music is actually playing and giving little vibrations in different parts of their arms and their body and such. So it's creating this sense of kind of physical music, right? The vibrations in your arms, in one arm corresponds with one kind of note, and the other arm a different kind of note, and so on. So we did a kind of ethics of, we did an ethical evaluation of that technology. And one thing we asked about from the top down, we said, well, let's think about dignity. Does dignity exist anywhere in here? And one place where it does exist is in the question about the original music. So this musician was playing standard, this is in Italy, so this musician was playing music by other composers that is well known. So you have this question, well, it's true that that music is by a composer that is well known, but this player is adding all of these other factors, right? These motors, these engines, and adding these effects of the music and the technology of the artificial intelligence and the computer. And we ask, well, at what point, right, at what point can we say that the music that's being played no longer belongs to that original author? Right? Now this music is really a new creation, which is done by the artificial intelligence / musical team in Italy. Now, if we were lawyers, we would talk about something like copyright. Right? We would say, well, wait a minute, is this music being stolen from the original writer? But in ethics, right, we speak differently. We talk about dignity. It's not a question of legal specific rules. It's more a human question about whether or not this music, that this player can take credit for this music, or if he, in this case, it's he, is simply repackaging the music that someone else produced. I don't know what the answer to that is, But I know that's a dignity question. It's about the dignity of the original author, right? The original composer of the music. Is his music being her, I can't remember who it was, but his or her music being used in this experiment? Or is that just a new song which was inspired by that original music? And it's hard to tell because we're going from an acoustic instrument to motors on the body and so on. And is it the same thing or is it different? Where is the originality? How original is it? What exactly is the composition? Who is the composer? All those kinds of questions were discussed underneath the idea of dignity. Dignity meaning who has, in some sense, the human right to claim ownership of the music? Is it the person who wrote the song? Is it the person who's playing the song here? Is it the person who did the artificial intelligence? Is it the person who made the motors on these vests? Very, very complicated. But it was interesting to think about all of those things. And it was interesting to think about it in a way which was not legal, right? We weren't looking at law books. And anyway, law books, this goes back to the original point. And law books can't keep up. I mean, law books, when they are laws that are made to govern the regulations of copyright in music, they didn't foresee this kind of artificial intelligence stuff. So copyright doesn't work. when you want to talk about whose song it is, you need to talk about dignity. Does the song still belong to the original composer? Or is this someone else's song now? Whose song is it? Who is the author? That's a dignity question that we asked. So that was a top-down, that was a result of a top-down analysis. We also did one result of the bottom-up analysis is we said that there is an increase of autonomy here. And the first thought we had was that this would allow people who are hearing impaired to have a better sense of the music. So it provides autonomy in the sense that people who could not fully experience music before now can more, of course, if you're hearing impaired, you don't fully experience it, but through these motors, they have a closer to a full experience of the music. So it increases their self-determination, their ability to decide they want to have music in their lives. So in that way, this experiment boosts human autonomy. And then we thought, you know, if it's true for the hearing impaired, it's probably actually true for everybody. It gives us a new way of experiencing music, and anything that provides us with new opportunities, new possibilities, new ways of experiencing music or food or anything else that you can come up with, all those things, those are all autonomy benefits. They're all giving us more control over our lives. They're all allowing us to make determination across a wider range of experience. So we say, look, going from the bottom up, this is very positive in terms of autonomy. And so we talked about that. Then we had a Zoom meeting about that. And then I say here we consolidate in terms of principles, draft, and commentary. So what you do here is on that same Google Doc, you go down and you talk about each one of the principles that exist. You say, look, here's the ethics evaluation. In terms of dignity, these are the issues that come up, and these are the results of our discussions. In terms of autonomy, these are the issues that come up, and these are the results of our discussions. And you do that for the whole set of principles. So that's what the evaluation looks like. You start with both the human experience of the machine and ask how that fits into the principles, and you start with the principles and ask how that fits into the machine. And you just do that for all the principles. And then when you're done with that, as I say, you write that up in an organized way. That's section two of the paper, and that's the heart of the paper. So the first part is you explain what the machine is. The second part, you explain how it relates to ethics. And then in the third part, you would summarize and you might provide recommendations of one kind or another. For example, going back to the heart case, of course, there the recommendation was, look, our conclusion was this machine seriously inhibits human autonomy. It does not do what it promises. It said it would help people be freer and live better. It makes them live, it has them living worse and being less free. So we recommend that you make some kind of change to increase the autonomy level of the machine. So that would be a recommendation that you can make. but you don't necessarily make recommendations. In the case of the music, I think that we made some recommendations about ownership of the music and how we would attribute it and that kind of thing. But as I say, recommendations are optional. The reason for the ethics evaluation is to understand what's happening in ethical terms. Recommendations may follow from that, of course, naturally, but not necessarily. That's not the heart of the endeavor. So frequently we think when we do kind of reports on things and so on, that they're action-oriented necessarily. That is, the reason for the report is so we can do something. That usually makes sense, but that's not necessarily true with an ethics evaluation. An ethics evaluation may just say, look, the way things are is good, but now we more fully understand what the machine is and how it works on the human level. So I want to really stress that the evaluation is about understanding how it works, not about the recommendations. Though recommendations do tend to follow naturally from understanding, of course. Mm-hmm. So that's what an AI ethics audit looks like. And then, of course, I've said that there's this Google Doc running Google Doc. Well, you just write that as the third part of the Google Doc. And by the time you're done, you've got a paper that can be published if you want. We've published 5 or 6 of these ethics audits composed just the way I described them. These three parts: first the technical, social, technical scenario, then the evaluation, then some concluding thoughts and possibly recommendations. Many journals will publish those kinds of articles. And then, of course, companies are interested in having those kinds of reports for themselves about their own products. I will say there, that's what the audit is. It's those three parts, and it's the resulting document. In my experience, in the last point here, major areas, in my experience, frequently questions arise about autonomy, frequently questions arise about privacy, and frequently questions arise about fairness and explainability. We will be talking about that later on. But in my experience, those are sort of the big ones that come up over and over again. But there are, of course, dignity considerations and equity considerations and so on, which are also important in at least some AI and tech innovations. Okay, so that's what an AI ethics audit is. Okay, I'm going to do one more thing just quickly. That's the most important thing I wanted to do. I wanted to show you what an AI ethics audit is and how you make one. I think I've just explained that fairly clearly. After initially explaining why we want them. We want them because laws can't keep up. Now, the last thing we're going to do today is just very quickly, a kind of example, just run through for you what it might look like to do one of these. This is something I'm actually working on myself, and I think other people are too, in this world of generative AI. There's a lot of material, as you can imagine, and that shows me teaching things like ethics. And so we're trying to make an agent or a bot or what have you that is me talking about ethics. So if someone like you had an ethics question at 3 a.m., you could go online and ask this James bot your ethics question. And presumably the James bot would give you an answer just like I would give you were I not sleeping. This allows me to answer questions 24 hours a day and also get normal amounts of sleep. So I'm working on a company to make that. And we could say, okay, great. So here you go. Here is a tech ethics advance and innovation. Let's do an audit, a tech audit of it, or a tech ethics audit of it, or an AI ethics audit of it. And that's going to be the three parts: the socio-technical scenario, the evaluation, the report recommend. What would that look like? Well, you would gather together everyone who's involved, from me to me as the subject, to me as the philosopher, to the computer scientist. One group that would be important to include in this would be students. I think that one of the main reason for developing this technology is that sometimes it happens. At least I have found this. Sometimes students are almost a little bit embarrassed. I know, let's say me. When I was a student, I was sometimes embarrassed to ask some questions because I didn't want to look like dumb, first of all. And also sometimes what happened, I would ask a question of a professor and get an answer. And I remember I would understand it at the time, but then the next day I would wake up and now I don't understand it again. And I would like to go back and ask again, but then I really would look dumb, right? So I was kind of afraid to ask again. Or I would look like I was using up too much of the professor's time or something. I think for things like that, it would be really useful to have a kind of an agent that would talk like the professor, right? So if you can make it work, and we'll see how well we can make it work. But if you could, it seems like that would be very positive for students to be able to just ask anytime a professor a question about their class. And they could perhaps also, and this would be, so I guess that would be the socio-technical scenario. We would talk about the large language models and how they work and where the data came from and what data we used and why we used it. All that stuff would be the socio-technical scenario. And then we would evaluate it. We could say, well, this, what does this do for autonomy? We say, well, yeah, it helps students' autonomy a lot. Now, here's something we might ask having to do with autonomy and privacy. We might ask, look, should we take the name of the students who are asking questions? This is something we've actually talked about with them. On the one hand, if you take the name of the students, that's going to help you make the machine better. It is, because if a student keeps coming back and asks the same question, that kind of tells you the machine is not giving a good answer to that question. So it gives you something you can look at and try and improve. But on the other hand, the whole purpose of the machine is to let students just freely ask questions. And so in that way, maybe it would be best to allow the machine or to have the machine function anonymously. That is, we just don't record who is asking. We record the question, of course, we have to, but we don't record who is asking the question. So we just have a bunch of questions coming through. And it seems like that you could defend that in terms of autonomy, because students would feel less constrained, less embarrassed if they ask the same question. So if you're a student, you can ask the James bot the same question 100 times. No shame, no embarrassment. Just keep asking until you get an answer that works for you. So it would seem like it would increase student autonomy to not take their names. And of course, it would also increase privacy. So I'm kind of rushing through this, but I think you get the idea of how, what I'm trying to show is how an ethics audit can really be a very positive part of the development of this technology. Right? So we've done the socio-technical scenario. We've explained the bot is a James bot, and what it does is it answers questions about ethics for students and anyone else. And then we've evaluated. We've said, look, there's this question about autonomy and privacy. And then maybe in the final part, the report recommend, we could say, look, we've decided that we are not going to take the names of the students. And we've decided that even though it will harm the performance of the machine, we think that the ethical value of the increased autonomy and increased privacy carries more weight, is more significant than the loss of performance. And we know that, we think that, because we've talked with the AI designers and students and so on, going back to the socio-technical scenario, again, it's why it's so important to have students there, professors there, the computer scientists there. With that whole group there, only with that whole group there, can you effectively weigh this difference. Say, look, the computer scientist tells you, we're not losing too much performance if we don't take names. Or maybe the computer science people say, we are losing a lot of performance if we don't take names. So maybe we should think about this again. Maybe we should say, look, even though it diminishes the autonomy of the students and diminishes their privacy, we should still force them to give the names, because it's going to make the machine work so much better. Well, that would be part of kind of the report recommend stage. But coming up with that question would be part of the evaluation stage. Okay, I think you sort of get the idea, and I think I've been sufficiently clear in the first example for you to see in your own minds how this would break up, right? So the first, in step one, you would gather Brousseau plus the computer scientists plus the students plus maybe the dean from the school or something, or someone from the dean's office, all get together and talk about what the device does and why it does it. It's there to help students get answers for questions in their class. Then you do the evaluation. You think about the autonomy. Well, it increases their autonomy because they get these answers. It decreases their privacy if they have to give their name. but we can increase the privacy by not having them give their name. If we were doing fairness, we're only talking about autonomy, dignity, and privacy, because that's what we've done. But if we were doing fairness, we might worry a little bit about people using this device to do well on the exam without studying, something like that. So that will all be part of the evaluation. And then the report recommend, well, do we take the names or not? Or maybe if we decide in the extreme case that students will just use this to cheat on the exams, then we should not do it at all. But there's a lot of different ways of, or a lot of different conclusions that may appear in the report and recommend section. Okay, but what's most significant is that this kind of evaluation really helps the machine work better, right? I mean, just thinking about this discussion about should the students turn their name in or not. And that's a hard decision. Depending upon how much performance we're losing versus how much privacy and autonomy we are gaining. There's no right or wrong answer to that question, but there are better and worse understandings of the question. And that's why you do the AI ethics audit or the tech ethics audit. You do it to make sure you understand the question perfectly or as well as possible. And then you make the best decision you can. No guarantees about the decision, but the better you understand the question, the better the decision is likely to be. And that's the reason for an AI or tech ethics audit. Okay? Okay, good. Why don't you take a few minutes to sketch the ethics evaluation of the example case, right, the James bot, or anything else for that matter. Just run through what the process would look like in your own mind with one or another product, either the James bot or any other product you like. And then I think that will be enough for this session.